Good morning, world diners and travelers, and good morning to Peter, as usual.
World travelers and diners. I guess we are going out globally, aren't we?
We are indeed.
So it's this afternoon to all of you in Europe. It's
tomorrow.
Well, by the time you're listening down under, you better be listening because you're featured on the program today. Certainly hope all our friends in Tasmania, fondly known as Tassie, are listening because we're going to feature you on the program today. But first up, we have another order of business, I think. We had an interesting guest who wrote a book that seems to infringe on Dr. Seuss, but it's called Blue Eggs and Something.
And Yellow Tomatoes.
Blue Eggs and Yellow Tomatoes, and I think that author Jean
Kelly... Gorgeous book. Absolutely gorgeous book.
And I think the author speaks for herself about what the book's all about.
Jean Kelly, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you.
You know, Jean Kelly is a very, we're Pittsburgh-based, so Jean Kelly is an important name in this area, with Jean. Anyhow, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about this gorgeous, gorgeous book that you have out, Blue Eggs and Yellow Tomatoes.
Now, Dr. Seuss didn't sue you, did he?
No.
No.
At least not yet.
Now, Jean, you have... you attended La Varenne,
yes.
And you have affiliated with Bon Appetit magazine for 20 years. And are you still a contributing editor?
Yes, I still am a contributing editor. I do a lot of work for them. I also do a lot of work for Cooking Light magazine.
Right. And you live just outside of Los Angeles. Do we call you an urban gardener?
Yes, I think of myself as an urban gardener. I live about 10 minutes from downtown Los Angeles. From my home, I see lots of urban sprawl, uh-huh. But I also see lots of beautiful mountains because this is Southern California. We've got that odd mix here. And so I really make the most of what I have, of the small bit of land that I have available to me.
But you have a blessed climate, right? The sun shines almost every day, so...
can grow things year-round.
So it's called add water, but other than that, you can grow just about anything.
Yeah, it's really something to be able to garden year-round, especially if you have a passion for it like I do. Although, I have so many friends who live where they can garden in the summertime, and they do such a remarkable job because I think they're not being able to grow stuff in the winter makes it so that they really want to make the most of the growing season.
Uh-huh. Now, explain the concept of your book. I might say that, I mean, we get dozens of cookbooks weekly. I've never had one that has tips on how to raise chickens.
I know. I think there is a growing movement with this idea of people wanting to produce food at their home because safety issues, environmental issues, cost factors. It's a nice thing to be able to do to be part of the food chain. So I felt like it was fitting to have the section about the raising hens in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's allowed here, and we have an awful lot we have a whole movement of urban farmers in Pittsburgh, in this area.
Yeah, that's great.
I've checked it out. You can keep bees and you can raise chickens right in the city.
That's fantastic. I love hearing that when I hear from cities that allow that to happen because a lot of people don't realize that they can do that.
Now, I don't know about goats, but we had a neighbor that had piglets and they didn't stay.
they sort of gave themselves away. And it wasn't the oink oink.
No, yes.
Now, this book is just beautiful, as I said. I mean, the coloring is wonderful. You have a homey touch with this kind of gingham theme in the paper and the photographs. Tell us what your concept is.
Well, it's primarily a collection of, I think, excellent recipes. You know, I feel like I had all these recipes that I continued to want to make over and over again. And so I like to think of them as keepers. I like to think of these as recipes that almost every cook should have in their repertoire. But then I felt like, well, you know, so much of what I do as a cook involves growing and the chicken, so I thought it would be fun to add that too. My style of cooking is... I'm influenced a lot by all the different, you know, ethnic groups that live in my neighborhood. So I'm always, And then I love to travel, so I'm always incorporating new flavors into foods.
Oh, yeah, you have all kinds of ethnic references in here.
Yes. Well, I want to explain to people what every single ingredient is, because a lot of people might not know what sumac is, and it's a pretty rare one. Mostly I try to stick to things that you can get at the market. But every once in a while, I think it's fun to introduce a new ingredient to people and just explain what it is and how you can get it. What with the internet, it's so remarkable. So many ingredients you can get online that it doesn't really matter where you live anymore. You can have the world's, you know, pantry right there. So,
well, I mean, I like the person, your personality coming through here. You have a section on pantry and equipment stocking guide, and it's very personal. I mean, like you say, sometimes I make my own chicken broth from a roast chicken carcass. And I've never made homemade beef broth or stock, you know, and that kind of thing. And then the elements that you have in your pantry, some of them, in fact, a lot of them I actually have too, but you have some rather unusual ones too, which shows the ethnic influence. I mean, I would not envision, what is sriracha sauce as a staple?
Oh, sriracha sauce. That is just a wonderful hot sauce. Mm-hmm. And I love the story behind it. It's just this wonderful hot pepper sauce that's made here in Los Angeles. And it's a Vietnamese hot sauce.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and it's just, it's everywhere. I mean, you go to Mexican restaurants here and you see it because it's got just this wonderful kind of sharp garlicky flavor. And you can get it at most supermarkets. It seems it's got a very rare, fancy name, but it's actually something that's pretty easy to find.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was pleased to see you like Allclad since they're manufactured right near us.
Well, yeah, I love Allclad. And, you know, the book has a, you know, all the photographs were taken in Philadelphia.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I flew out to Philadelphia and I spent 10 days preparing all the food that was photographed. So, yeah, it's got a Pennsylvania thing to it.
Boy, you must have been a busy girl. I mean, listeners, this is a great book. This is a great big cookbook.
Yes, I was a busy girl. We did about 8 to 10 photographs a day.
Oh my goodness! And then did you eat everything afterwards?
We did. We did. We'd sit down and have it for lunch, and you know, and then there was the assistant to the photographer had lots of brothers, and so anything that we didn't finish, we could pack up for Carrie, and then she would take them.
Oh, that's wonderful. But one of the wonderful things about this book, aside from the fabulous title, is the way you begin by saying this: in order to be able to cook effectively using the recipes from a book like this one, this is what you have to have in the larder. I mean, it's very systematic. We've had other people do that as well, but you seem to have a very richly endowed larder. And now, how many of the things in the larder are things that actually come from your garden, and how many come from the store, do you think? Is it like 50-50 or 60-40?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the pantry has a lot of the canned goods, dry goods, spices and things. And then I like to, you know, have most of the stuff from the garden that I bring up and think like, okay, what can I prepare with this today? So mostly the pantry items are dry goods because it's hard to kind of tell people to keep fresh things on hand because fresh things go bad.
Right. I like some of you. I keep a lot of things in the freezer, and you said you're not a freezer person, but there are certain things that, like nuts, that you're not going to use right away.
Right. Well, as I say, I always have chicken thighs, boneless, skinless chicken thighs in the freezer. I love those. I always have blueberries, blackberries, the chili chipotles, and, of course, vanilla ice cream.
Now, if you were to pick out some recipes in this book, what would you point to as your favorites?
Oh, gee, that's hard. There are so many good ones in the book. One of my favorite things is the chocolate cake. I think the recipe for the chocolate cake is just worth the price of the whole book.
Really?
Yeah.
I think I missed it. I'm not a sweets person, so. What's unique about it?
You don't even need to be a sweet person because there's so much bittersweet chocolate in it.
Oh.
I like it in the sense that, you know, like everyone, you know, sometimes you have a little bit of a lazy bone. And I like the fact that it's a cake where you just, you melt your butter and your chocolate with water, and you whisk your eggs with your sugar, and then you add your flour and you just kind of dump it. It's that easy. And the frosting is the same thing. You don't even need to own an electric mixer for the cake. And it's just so rich, and it's, to me, it's just the perfect chocolate cake. And there's something about a piece of chocolate cake with you know, a glass of milk that is just, you can't beat. But then getting away from things like chocolate cake, if you want to be more on the health conscious side. I love the fact that I have a chapter on pizza and pasta. I love to make pizza. I also really like the chapter on sandwiches.
Oh, those, that's very good. They're called fat sandwiches.
Yes. I mean, sandwiches, I think, are just overlooked because it's everything right there. I mean, we eat sandwiches for dinner all the time. We're busy, you know. Sometimes we don't have time to sit down to, you know, our roast and our starch and our vegetables. Sometimes it's like, okay, we're on the go. And if you just make like a beautiful sandwich and serve it with a salad, I think that's just a perfect meal. It makes everybody
give us
happy.
An example of your favorite sandwich that you have in this cookbook.
Oh, gosh, there are so many good ones. The obviously, the bacon double A and T sandwich, which is a bacon, avocado, arugula.
That's good.
And tomato sandwich is really something. I mix Dijon mustard and mayonnaise with a little bit of garlic and green onion. And so that makes a great, you know, little sauce for it. And then, you know, with a homegrown tomato and freshly picked arugula, it's fabulous. And even with, you know, a farmer's market tomato and some supermarket arugula or lettuce, it would be great too.
Well, I just think it's a wonderful cookbook. The recipes are fresh and creative. And there's so many really happy tips. I don't know how else to explain it. For just getting the most out of, if you grow it yourself or you get it locally from your farmer's market or one of your CSA programs, and you make it very exciting. You make the like asparagus and peas with green garlic, a Swiss chard with morel mushrooms and chalice. Nothing wrong with that, Jean. I hope that listeners rush out and buy this book, and I need to congratulate you on it because it's a treasure.
Oh, well, thank you, Anne.
So, anyhow, let us know when you're doing the next one.
Okay.
And while we're at it, why don't we give your website so people can go directly to your website.
Okay, great. It's www.jeannekelly.com.
And I haven't checked that out yet, but I'm going to.
Oh, yeah. Please do.
And the book, listeners, is called
The Book Blue Eggs and Yellow Tomatoes.
And it's beautiful. Sky blue in color. Thanks again, Jean, for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
Okay. Hope to meet you sometime.
I hope so, too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye, Peter.
Well, I always enjoy talking to her. I think it's about time, though, that we have a pause for the cause. And then when we come back, we'll talk Tassie.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Peter is sort of twitching to introduce our next series of interviews.
I don't know. Peter's probably twitching for another reason, but never mind, listeners. Let's not go there. One of the most exciting places on the planet, and it's exciting because it's almost like a private place, so few people seem to go there, is the island state off the bottom right-hand corner of Australia called Tasmania. We've been there a number of times, and every time we go to Australia, we go back because we always discover something new. On this occasion, we interviewed some really quite remarkable people that you're going to meet during the course of the rest of the program. But first pride of place goes to the man without whom there wouldn't be a wine industry in Tasmania. His name is Dr. Andrew Pirie, and essentially they said it couldn't be done, and his study said it could, and here's the rest of his story.
On the Menu frequently says we're talking to an icon, but in this case we truly are. We're on the island state of Tasmania, We're talking to Australia's very first doctor of viticulture, Dr. Andrew Peary, who's once again emerged as a winemaker here in Tasmania. That's a long story, which we might go over, but we're sitting on the Tamar Ridge on the western side of the Tamar River, northern Tasmania, looking over a vineyard property for which he's the winemaker. And we've been drinking wines, talking about wines. Now I want you to hear from the man himself. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you from this beautiful setting.
And what's going on here? You've been here about 2 years, you said. So you're setting about a whole portfolio of wines coming to market that are different. Take us through those.
Okay. My job is to guide what is now the largest wine group in Tasmania. And that includes my own brand, Peary and South, which are part of the portfolio. And we're looking to build a, what I'd call a regionally based range of wines. And so we're presenting wines from different parts of the island, in particular the Tamar Valley, and even each end of the Tamar Valley. We want to bring the taste of the island to the world in all its detail. And in particular, we're specializing in Pinot Noir, Riesling, Pinot Gris, Sauvignon Blanc, which are all the varieties that do well in this particular temperature.
But as we started our conversation, you said there was a landmark report that was very interesting, I think in 1972, that said you couldn't grow wine grapes in Tasmania at all. So you must have sort of ignored that direction?
Yes, I'd come from France. I'd been working in France for a year, and I had a scientific background, and I was intrigued as to where in Australia we could find French cool climate zones. The figures said that Tasmania was it. The dogma at the time was that Tasmania was too cool. That's obviously proven wrong, because Tasmania is now probably the trendiest wine region in Australia.
But it wasn't almost so, and you must have been making wines when it wasn't quite like that. So how do you think that happened?
Well, certainly at the beginning it was tough, because we even had trouble convincing the bank manager to support us. The wines spoke for themselves in the early days. Piper's Brook, which was my first venture, started to make an impact globally. People appreciated the styles. We were still a lot of homework to do in terms of clones, location of varieties, and so on. We have figured a lot of that out in detail now, but even at the beginning, the promise was there, and we were able to show really what was special about Tasmania.
But the great news is these wines aren't a secret anymore. You were telling us about markets around the world where they're in distribution, and you're going to do more.
Yes, we have struck a worldwide market, and we're now big enough to need one, and we're very happy to send wine to Finland, Norway, Quebec, and we're sending wine to all those markets as we speak. So the world is becoming a small place, and there are actually very limited areas on the planet where you can grow Pinot Noir of the style that we're making, and the other areas are, of course, Oregon, New Zealand, as well as France. So we're lucky to be in that small category of what we call Region 1 climates, where you can do the sort of things that we're doing.
Now, we're drinking some very food-friendly, forward Pinot Noirs that are mid-market range, but we also know that when you were at Piper's Brook, you were making wines with a real signature, wines that you expected would have a 25 to 30-year lifespan. Is the same thing going to happen here?
Yes, I've been keen to do what I would call the ultimate long-living Pinot Noir. Such a wine was made first in 2005, but almost beneath our feet in the cellars here. A very great vintage. We selected a small vineyard that I had helped develop many years ago, and that wine is now on the path. It's our first what we'd call icon wine. We expect that to express its site very well. It's the first time I've left Pinot Noir in barrel for an 18-month aging period, and the results are very exciting. So, yes, we're going for the top, and we'll always strive for that.
Now, when that's not released yet, so when it's released, what will it be called?
It'll be called the Sigma, and after the Greek letter or symbol, and that refers to that wine will be always our top Pinot Noir category. And we have one other just emerging as I think of it, which is a very late harvest Riesling. We're calling it a Super Botrytis, and it's equivalent to a Trockenbeeren Auslese in the German scale. Very sweet Riesling with great great finesse. So we've got a couple of exciting things coming through in the next few months.
Now you talked to us about another project too, which is your, you said your retirement plan. But I guess we better save that story for another day. You, what you must promise to do is you must promise to get in touch with On the Menu when you start with that. But let's let listeners know a little bit more about this region that we're in, because Tamar Ridge is a wonderful place, but it's a part of a whole region that in and of itself is a wonderful wine adventure.
The region is dominated by its temperature. When you see raspberries growing, black currants, you get the feeling how cool we are. We're clearly around the same zone as Dijon in Burgundy, or I presume Dundee Hills in Oregon. And that means that we not only produce Pinot Noir, but we have fine venison, great seafood, and there's a great tendency to celebrate the produce of this island with the wine. So it'll be rare that you'll have wine tasting without some food to represent the total package.
We have some cheese on the table that's local too, but Anne wants to say a word.
I wanted to let everyone know that you can come here, you can browse through the wines, you can taste the wines, you can dine, you can also stay. There are rooms here, and it's, I believe, 5-star accommodations. Let's have a website.
Well, before we get to that, I just wanted to let people know how accessible it is. Being the obsessive geographer that I am, you can fly from Melbourne, Australia, to Launceston several times a day, an hour's flight time, and drive time of probably 35 minutes to get to the southern end of the Tamar. And then there's a wine route which goes either side of this wonderful river valley with only one disadvantage. There's only one bridge. So if you come, chances are you'll want to make more than one day of it, and this is a place to stay. So let's, as Anne suggested, pick up the website for the winery and the website for the accommodations.
Yes, the wine route, we call it, the Tamar Valley Wine Route, is it's a 1 or 2 day circuit, and great diversity around the routes, from small wineries to large, and all interesting interpretations of their philosophy. So I think you'll enjoy that.
Andrew, thank you so much for talking to us, and please come back. Please come back and tell us more about all your new adventures. Oh, the website is?
Okay, I suggest both the Tamar Ridge website, which will bring you through to all the wine brands, and Rosevere's estate website, which will bring you through to the site and the accommodation. So, yep, Rosevere's estate, .com.au, and Tamar Ridge, all one word, .com.au.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Dr. Andrew Peary. I understand you have you're starting to pick tomorrow, so I know you must rush off. Do you have a last thought for listeners?
Well, people say, what's the vintage like, 08? The answer is we don't know yet. We won't know until we put the wine into tank. One of the wonderful things about wine is that each year has got a different character and challenge, so we're up for another one. Keeps us young and interested, so... Yep, look forward to 08.
A truly interesting man, Dr. Peary, and very modest about his great achievements.
Oh, he's amazing. Humble.
In terms of creating an industry, and not only that, having done it once and then doing it all over again. Now, it turns out that one of the things that Dr. Peary discovered was that although vines would prosper in Tasmania, it would be a good idea to use the cool climate grapes like Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris and... managed to do some Chardonnay as well, just nicely. What that does is it makes Tasmania a region that's excellent for producing sparkling wine. Notice we're not using the word champagne, but we are calling it sparkling wine. And Piper's Brook, which was his vineyard the first time, made an excellent range of sparkling wines. And a neighbor vineyard called Jance, which is actually represented by negotiants and our friends at Yolumbo, whom you've met before on the program. And we had the opportunity to head for Janssen, talk to a winemaker who's in two cases quite the opposite of Dr. Piri. First of all, she's quite young, and secondly, she's also of the opposite gender. But at the same time, right on top of her game, and we had the opportunity to sip just a little bit and talk to the winemaker at Sparkling Vineyard producer Jantz.
Natalie Fry has a great job, and she doesn't work for Kentucky Fried Chicken. She's the winemaker of a sparkling wine specialty wine house in Tasmania, right next door to Andrew Peary's old property, Piper's Brook, appropriate because we were just talking to him. And he said, you know, you have to go to Jantz. They're right next door, and they're doing wonderful things with sparkling wine. So, Natalie, is that true?
Well, I have to thank Andrew for that. Yes, we are doing, well, I think we're doing some pretty wonderful things with sparkling wine. We're very fortunate in that I believe we've probably got the strongest sparkling wine vineyard in Australia. Tasmania is certainly, in the last 15 years, emerged as the best place in Australia to grow sparkling wine. We think probably the best place outside of France to grow sparkling wine. So it's pretty exciting. It's a great project to be involved in. And I love the region. I love the state. And luckily for me, I love sparkling wine. So it is a pretty great job.
How did you get to be a sparkling winemaker? Was it something you always wanted to do?
It wasn't. When I first started, I just wanted to be a winemaker. I can't really think back to that time. It was so long ago. In the early to mid-90s, there was an opportunity to work for Seppelt's, which was at that stage Australia's sort of best known sparkling.
Yeah, they make Great Western, correct?
And I moved to Great Western and lived there for years learning to make sparkling wine, and then an opportunity came up for this project, and feeling as I did then about, you know, having made sparkling wine for 5 or 6 years about sparkling wine, I thought, well, there isn't going to be a better opportunity to make Great Australian sparkling wine than this one. So I grabbed it and moved south to Tassie.
And that's been pretty exciting since you got here.
It has. It's been fantastically challenging, but really quite rewarding. You know, I've made some wines that have been very exciting because they've very, very much represented the place, the vineyard, the climate, the region. It's been really a great challenge, but really exciting to see those wines come to fruition. One of the things about sparkling wine is that you make them and then 5 years later you see them as wines. It takes a long time to make a good sparkling wine, sometimes even 10 years. So it's really exciting to see the fruition. Of course, if you make a mistake, it takes you 5 years to correct it because you can't really see it until 5 years later. So it can be quite challenging that way.
Because it's got to go through this multi-stage developmental process, right?
It does. You make the base wine as you would any white wine, really. And then you have to go through the secondary fermentation in bottle. And then you've got to age them and age them and age them. And the wines, for people who aren't familiar with how wines change as they age, it can be quite shocking to see a sparkling wine when it's still in the bottle, still on lees, go through its secondary fermentation. And it can be a little bit scary, even for a winemaker who's been doing it for years and years and years and years. It can be scary when you go, oh, this wine's looking very different. But they always pull up in the end, so that's good.
So during that middle range, you sort of worry, is this ever going to be a wine?
I had that problem with the 03 vintage, which is the current vintage wine that is released. And in 05, 06, I was going, I don't know about this wine, but it actually, as it matured, just developed so beautifully, and it's such a lovely wine now. But it's kind of like, you know, they are very much like your babies, and they can go through some pretty awkward stages, and you have to love them at those stages as well as when they're looking fantastic.
Now, how would you compare your sparkling wine to a sparkling wine from the Champagne region in France?
I think, you know, the thing about it is they are very different because they are grown in different places. I've spent a bit of time in Champagne, and was fortunate enough to visit some absolutely spectacular houses and spend time there. And I took away a lot of confidence about having a house style, being confident about making something that's individual and distinct and sticking with it, not copying anyone else. I think, you know, we've moved away from copying Champagne to using some of the philosophies that the Champenois use, which is having a house style, representing a place, a sort of attention to detail and sort of commitment to quality that is evident in France, and implementing those things here in Tasmania rather than just trying to tick the boxes and copy what they do is actually think about the philosophies that have stood well in Champagne for hundreds of years.
So part of that local thing is just the flavors and the qualities associated with the Chardonnay and the Pinot Noir that's grown here rather than the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir that's grown in France?
Exactly right. I mean, this vineyard is a maritime vineyard because it's quite near the coast. It's only 5 minutes to the beach. So that has an effect on the vineyard. The soil here is very different to what you'd see anywhere else. But rather than going, oh, what do? We need to be more like France. We say, actually, a lot of the Champagne Wild would kill to have a soil like this, a climate like this, reliable production every year. So we sort of embrace all the positives about our region, which is, you know, just a fantastic place to grow sparkling wine, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. It's beautiful.
Now, we've been encountering an increasing number of women winemakers. Why is this? Would you like to address the issue?
I think it's increasing because previously, like in most professions, women were underrepresented. And some of those barriers are breaking down, and it's such a great career. There's no reason why women wouldn't want to be involved in it. And there's nothing to stop us. As previously, there was tradition and there was lots of kind of external social factors that kept women out of the wine industry. But now that they've been broken down to a pretty great extent, I think more and more women are now joining it. When I went through university, there was 8 women in my year, and that was the largest intake of women ever. And now I think, you know, it's so much more. It might even be like 50% of undergraduates for winemaking degrees might be women in Australia. I'd love to get that checked out, but there is an increasing number, and it can only be a good thing. I mean, you know, each of the sexes bring different things to the winemaking business, which is great, really positive. I mean, my boss is a woman. It's great.
There are specifics, though. The buzz, the talk in the street is that women bring specific skills uniquely to this business.
Well, I think women bring unique specific skills to everything. So that's it. I mean, you know, there is a lot of talk. Some of it I think might be a little bit jingoistic. There's just a different way of looking at wine. And women, I mean, I know my style of winemaking is quite, it's elegant, finesse, delicacy. They're the things I look for. They might be described as feminine traits. I'm not sure. It's just, you know, men and women do think in different ways. We might come up with the same outcome, but we think in different ways to get to that outcome. And I think that's really important to have that range in the industry. It's great.
Okay, we're at the Piper's Brook turnoff on the Tasmanian Tamar Wine Trail, about an hour from Launceston, about an hour and 15 minutes from Devonport. Natalie assures me, because that's where we're going next. And you have a website that people can get all the details.
Yeah, we do. It's www.jantz.com.au.
And that's J-A-N-S-Z, Z, listeners. Yeah. J-A-N-S-Z.com.au. Natalie, a last thought for the On The Menu family?
I'm really excited to talk about this region and making sparkling wine from this region, because I know the discovery I made when I first started drinking these wines was so great. It was so filled with so much pleasure. I can only hope that other people get the opportunity to taste it and maybe make the pilgrimage south to what could be described as the most beautiful island on earth.
Well, it's right up there, listeners. You must come. And Jantz must be a stop when you get here.
And now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On The Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're back. We're here again. Ross, can I say that? Don't forget, by the way, to email us.
We're back and we're front as well, probably.
Yeah, and sideways. Lots of sideways. Here we go. On the menu at onthemenuradio.com, and send us your suggestions, comments, positive criticisms, and whatever else. Now we're going to go from wine in Tasmania to food in Tasmania. And I'm going to ask you to introduce this because I can't pronounce this. I've tried. It's one of those, I don't know, okay, what kind of word
is
this it?
This is you. This is Peter. This is me, not you, I suppose, depending on your point of view. Anyway, it turns out that we returned to the Tamar Valley the very next day because we had an appointment to eat as well as to try some old wines, which we did too. And because wine and food, after all, do go together. It turns out that Daniel Alps at Strathlin, named after the chef, Daniel Alps, who you meet in just a moment, he's actually on the property of Piper's Brook, the vineyard that Andrew Peary founded. But it's actually on the land which produces a wine that we might be more familiar to listeners around the world, because it's the second popularly priced wine of Piper's Brook, called Ninth Island. So I won't go into the reasons why Tasmania is the Ninth Island, but there is a count which suggests that it is. But anyway, here we are talking to Chef Daniel Alps, who, it turns out, went around the world and then came back to Lonnie, Launceston, where he was raised, to establish this wonderful restaurant, and we enjoyed a great meal that he prepared for us.
Chef owner Daniel Alps, tell us the name of this restaurant, because it's an odd concept.
Well, Daniel Alps at Strathlin is what it currently known is now. The property about 20 years ago, when they first put a vineyard on it, had Strathlin on the gate. So that's where the Strathlin came from. It was an old farm. It was old piggery, actually, with all the acorn trees around. Then it's got turned into a vineyard. So we kept... It was a point of difference. When I used to work for Piper's Brook, the restaurant was just called Strathlin. But for the local... you know, customers and so forth, it was about Daniel owning the restaurant. So now that is the point of difference, so people are aware that it is it's a small family-owned restaurant.
Okay, and you said Ninth Island Vineyard, which is then also owned by Piper Brook.
The vineyard now has since been called, deceased as Strathlin. The restaurant still is, but the vineyard, they've got two labels of wine. One's the Ninth Island wine, one's the Piper's Brook. The Ninth Island's the early drinking range, so it needed a home. You know, it's such a popular wine within Australia and with also in a global market that it needed a presence, and this is obviously the perfect site for it.
Well, you're making quite a name for yourself as a chef. Let's step back. You are a native Taswegian.
Yes, Launcestonian, to be precise. Yep, born and bred in Launceston, and like all Tasmanians, they're drawn back to this place. So I studied my craft, and then travelled a little bit around Tassie, and then took off around Australia. Worked in Broome for 2 years, and then had a nice journey, 3 month journey back to Tasmania, where I was actually only stopping into this vineyard just to do a couple of casual shifts. And the rest is history, and that was about 12 years ago. So I've been very fortunate within working in a vineyard to have experienced and gone on some good, you know, winery tours through France and Oregon and all that stuff. So the travel, the yearning to keep experiencing new things has been fostered by the vineyard. So it's been very good to have that relationship. So instead of me packing up and moving on, they've kept me here, but at the same time they've kept that travel bug stimulated.
Now, to look at you, you look so young. It's hard to believe you have 20 years in the business. You've been cooking since you were 14?
Yeah, well, it was, I think, a love of late nights and a love of sleeping in and a joy of food that got me into the cooking trade. And, from once you're 14, once you start work, you just don't stop in this game. And I think it's the good thing about it is you finally realise when you get to about 34 that the longer you've been working, the less you have to rush and panic, and the more precise and the more simple and the more relaxed your food style becomes. So you actually only get to enjoy it after about 20-year apprenticeship, I reckon.
Now, you're very, very calm and composed. And what style food do you cook? You said simpler now.
Well, yeah, I think once you have an understanding of produce, that Tasmania's got, you know, some of the cleanest air, it's got some of the best pastures. So the produce that comes out of this state is, you know, first class, phenomenally good. Now understanding that you really don't need to do, well, not too much to it, but, you know, it's all about techniques and simplifying and just bringing out the quintessential flavour of the ingredient, which is pretty much what I'm focusing on. We're very lucky to have, we don't have wholesalers. We just have farmers that drop it off at the back door, and we just have to, at some times, well, not put up with what they give us, but, you know, like today we had 30 kilos of tomatoes arrive. So we've got to try and make a tomato sauce that goes with a few dishes.
We came carrying avos, organic avocados, from the Shaw plantation. Have there been any figures, I mean, chefs, that have been of enormous influence on you?
Well, I think Australian chefs, full stop, as being a Tasmanian, you know, going to Sydney, and I suppose I'll digress a little bit, that we've actually at Strathlin hosted numerous cooking schools of mainland chefs coming down for the local public, and that's been quite an inspiration. So instead of moving or going to the big cities to get inspiration, we bring the chefs to my restaurant. You know, they will cook for 30 people and demonstrate, and that gets you excited, and then you've got a nice relationship. So then when you go back to Sydney, you know, you can go to 5 or 6 restaurants and get very well looked after, and those sorts of things. It's very important for once every month to go to Melbourne or Sydney and get your stimulation. But having the best of both worlds, coming back to Tasmania and living here, it doesn't get much better.
What chefs do you like?
Well, Peter Doyle would be one of my favourites. Armando Bacour from Buon Ricardo. You know, you've got Sean from Sean Panorama. You've got Shannon Bennett, you know, Tegezard, Jeremy Strode. They're all, you know, there's that whole generation of Australian chefs which they've changed. Like once upon a time that, you know, as young Australians, you'd have to go to Europe to, you know, to earn your stripes. I don't believe that that's a necessity anymore. I believe that, you know, actually earning your stripes in Australia is a far better way, because we have a lot, an easier but dedicated approach to the way we sample food. Our lifestyle is relaxed, but, you know, it's seriously simple in Australia, and some of the best restaurant experiences, you know, are only an hour away by plane.
Now, your menu is daily changing, seasonal. Could you run us through just a few items that you might, they may not be signatures, but that you're particularly fond of?
Well, today we've actually, it's corn season in Tasmania at the moment, so we've got a rocket corn and pecorino salad on, which is a favourite, and you put that with a glass of Sauvignon Blanc, and, well, matched with this view, you couldn't get better anywhere else. You know, it's a nice, simple, it's a lighter style. We're also using a lot of the Tasmanian seafood, like the spring bay scallops, which, you know, are pretty famous little morsels in Tasmania, and we just serve them with a leek butter, and because we make all our bread daily, yesterday's bread turns into today's breadcrumbs. And it's, you know, there's that sort of that real artisan approach to cooking, which is, you know, you can't waste anything. You've got to use what's now. And that's more exciting than doing 150 covers or doing, you know, 10 course degustations. It's just our menus only consist of 5 things, and you can have them as an entree or a main. And for me, I believe that's all it should be for lunch.
Well, it sounds good. I can hardly wait. Do you have a website? How do people make reservations?
Still by the telephone. I wish I did have a website, but at the same time, you would have to then keep updating it to keep it current and you know, relevant. So still a mystery in the world is that, you know, to be really experienced Strathlin, you actually have to rock up, make a booking, and sit down and just enjoy it. So it's a little bit different. It's a little bit quirky, but it's still, a lot of people get upset with that, but that's the way I like it.
Well, you know, listeners, we're in the middle of this gorgeous vineyard. And, Daniel, you had some really interesting things to tell us about Piper's Brook and the kinds of things that the company is doing as a future investment, really.
Yeah, I think that they understand that what the significance of Tasmania is in the marketplace, which, you know, you don't find Tasmania everywhere you go. So they're slowly converting their vines to organic, which is, you know, fits in well with our philosophy, because all our fruit and vegetables are organic, so that's tremendous. Got some adjoining properties at the winery site, which they're farming Wagyu beef and putting in some wetland. So they're really, you know, it's a good sustainable long-term future for the vineyard.
What color, what do these Wagyu beef things look like? I've seen black Angus, and then I saw some cattle that had a, was black with a white stripe down the...
They're called belted Galloways. So look, basically it's the gene that's the Wagyu part of the animal, which, you know, they'll impregnate them, and then basically they will keep them on the pasture. They're not necessarily lot fed or grain fed. It's just that their marbling is a different structure to the other, just the plain black Angus. But there'll be a lot of people that argue that just a good piece of black Angus is as good as it gets. And I tend to be along those lines of thought. I think there's a marketing pitch that you can use for the Wagyu. But I still think a good bit of red black Angus on grass and lamb on grass is nothing better.
I'm with you. Well, thanks for talking to us, and I'm anxious to sample your food.
Thanks very much.
Well, hold on. We'll be back soon. talking about where to stay.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Hello again.
I thought you were going to say welcome back. You've got a new intro. Hello again. That's pretty clever.
I get tired of saying
you want to do the email thing again?
On the menu at onthemenuradio.com. You know, this, we've been doing this for so long, I guess, but I always learn something new. I forgot to mention I'd never heard of a piggery. Oops, that popped my pee.
Mrs. Haig popped a pee there, but that's okay. We'll see if we can fix that between now and when the program goes on the air.
But anyhow, when we keep seeing old friends and building connections to people, even halfway around the world. What's coming up next?
Well, we need to give some recommendations for places to stay and, incidentally, also to dine as well. We do something different than most tourists to Tasmania. We recommend that you do too. Most people head for Hobart, the state capital, which is on the southern side of the state, head for Port Arthur, the penal settlement, and all the things in that part of the island. We prefer the northern part of the island, which is even quieter. And you might say, well, that's fine, Peter, but where can you stay when you go to somewhere like that? Well, it turns out that over the visits that we've made, we found two excellent establishments. They'd probably be, fit into the restaurant with rooms sort of category, but they're both excellent locations. Glencoe, owned by our friends Remy and Jeanette Bancal, who used to be in Sydney and decided that they wanted to be in bucolic Tasmania instead. And then last up, we're going to talk to a member of the Hawley family, a representative of a group that owns a place called Hawley House, which is right on one of the most beautiful beaches I've ever seen in my whole life. And it turns out she's an interesting character. She's the next generation who's going to be taking over from her father, Simon. And she said some interesting adventures in her own right that she talked about, as well as Hawley House itself.
Well, let's talk to the people at Glencoe.
Yeah, so first up, we talked to Jeanette first about the accommodations there, and then we caught up with her husband, Remy, who doubles as the chef as well, and then we'll finish up with a visit to Hawley House.
Bonjour, Jeanette and Carl. We're so happy to see you again. It's been 5 years. And you've moved. Last we saw you, you were at Calstock, which was a historical property, and we had a wonderful time. But you're in a new historical property, at least it's a very charming farmhouse property, and it's called Glencoe. And the subtitle of this is why we're really here, called Rural Retreat, a Place of Harmony. That's wonderful.
Yeah, bonjour. Yes, we've moved effectively, and we have been at Glencoe Rural Retreat for 18 months now. And we are very happy, and it is a place of harmony, and we wanted to make it a place of harmony, and I think up to now we feel very comfortable with it. We think we have succeeded, more or less, and we'll see in the future what will happen.
Well, I can't wait to actually see who else is staying here. How many people do you accommodate?
We can accommodate up to 8 people. Maximum will be 9, but 8 people. That's, we have got 4 bedrooms.
And, of course, Remy, your husband, is a wine connoisseur and a chef. So it's a restaurant with rooms primarily, but also with a cafe?
Yes, it is. We have created this little country cafe, and we serve really simple French food. I mean, mainly French influence, but with a touch of Tasmania, of course, with all the fresh produce. And we are open to the public in the cafe from Wednesday to Sunday, and that's a little thing, a bit more than the room and also the dinner at night as well. Remy cooks beautiful dinner at night for the guests, and most of the clientele will have dinner with us. They are very happy to not have to drive outside and come back, and so it's just easy to eat, enjoy the food, the good wine, and go to bed.
Now, I mean, I guess I better mention that, I mean, it's obviously, it sounds like we're in France. But of course, I just wanted to make sure that everybody understands we're in Tasmania. But you're having a wonderful French experience if you come to this place in Tasmania. And there are all kinds of other things to do also. Could you just go through the kinds of things that your guests can do when they're in this particular a house? We call it a resort? No, it's not a resort. It's a more comfortable quiet.
Yes, while the guests stay with us, they can, of course, go to Cradle Mountain. That's all something very... Everybody wants to go there. We are only 40 minutes away from that. And then we have got the lovely town of Sheffield, the Murals. That's very quite impressive as well. And there is, of course, lots of walks, bush walks. The Mount Holland very close by, and so they don't even have to go to Cradle Mountain to do bush walking. There is fly fishing. There is Lake Barrington. That's beautiful as well, lovely. And also beautiful valleys, gun plains. There is lots of beautiful things to do, and gardens. Lovely gardens around here, very, all the north, it's very European, so it's very beautiful green and lovely trees. And wineries as well, we have got a few wineries around, very good wine. And so there is, whoever come here, they won't be bored, certainly, they will have a lot to do.
Well, listeners, we just adore them. And we were here, as I said before, and I want to give you a website. You can sort of go on this website and see what we're talking about. It's www.glencoruralretreat.com.au. Let me do it one more time. It's www.glencoeFARM.com.au. And it's a wonderful experience. These people are just born to hospitality, and we've always had a wonderful time with you. And I'm so pleased we're here again.
We are very happy to have you again as well, and it's wonderful to have guests coming back. And au revoir.
Well, we can't say au revoir because I think Peter wants to give me a geography lesson again.
Well, the wonderful thing about it is that it's a real 15-minute drive from the Devonport Airport. It's probably about 18 minutes from the Spirit of Tasmania ferry. So it's as accessible as you could possibly want to be in this part of Tasmania. And that's the great news. You just drive up the road, look for the little sign on the right-hand side, drive up the driveway, and it looks like a place that Jeanette designed. We were at Cowstock before, and everything inside was beautiful, and here is just the same.
So now we could say au revoir.
Au revoir. See you at Glencoe.
When On the Menu last met Remy Bancal, he was at a property called Cowstock, about 30 kilometers from where we are now in north-central Tasmania. We talked to Jeanette yesterday, and you probably have heard that interview already, but we wanted to catch up with Remy and find out what's happening in the kitchen that perhaps is the same or perhaps is different than what was happening before. Remy?
Hi, good morning, folks. It's Remy here speaking from the kitchen. Not much has changed from the two property, except a little bit of the approach, which is a little bit simpler, a little bit more down to earth. But product-wise, is the same, quality-wise, the same. And the feeling and personality behind it, it remain what it was. That's our philosophy in terms of food, presenting fine food, but comfortable. With no knick-knack sort of things.
So if I were to describe it as French country cuisine meets wonderful Tasmanian ingredients, would that be a good description?
I think you're right on the spot there.
Now dinner is still here. Dinner is a special meal, and you have dinner and stay over at Glencoe, just as you did at Cowstock. Just go over that with us if you would. And then there's another opportunity for people to enjoy your cuisine, which you didn't do before.
That's right, Peter. We still have the opportunity for people to come and stay with us and spend one or two days and discover the area and obviously the food that we can do here with the Tasmanian produce, you know, from the truffle to the salmon to all the spied and beautiful vegetables that Tasmania is well known for. So guests can stay and enjoy dinners with us, or if they're passing by because they're in a rush to go back to Cradle Mountain for whatever reason, we've decided to open a cafe at lunchtime. That is open from Wednesday to Sunday in summer. And we serve light lunches with a French flair. So you still have those traditional French country food, agremented by a light, you know, steak and salmon steak. That's our local. But we also do the lamb casserole and, you know, and confit en pork, and other traditional dishes. We also serve some beautiful goat cheese that are made here in Tasmania. Like a, you know, a little tartlet with tomatoes from the garden and herb and spice, agremented with local wine because we are surrounded here by three or four different wineries which are producing world wine classes. One of them is even served on Qantas first class. And well, you know, we're just very happy to welcome you in and see you there.
And listeners, it's a lovely spot, a beautiful garden with flowers, but also with a wonderful chef's garden out back. An absolutely charming sunlit terrace that we're looking out on as we talk this morning, and you pass right by. So as you drive from Devonport on the north coast, if you came in the Spirit of Tasmania or you flew in, you drive directly past. It's about 3 kilometres past Lower Barrington. If you get to the village of Barrington, I think you might have gone too far. Look for a big sign on the right-hand side, and do stop by, because it's just a perfect way to stop on the way there or on the way back from this magnificent geomorphological feature called Cradle Mountain, and another beautiful mountain too. There's a mountain off to the left. Tell me what that's called, Remy.
Well, out of the left, you've got something which is not really well known to visitor, which is called Mount Roland. It's a beautiful spot. It's a backdrop of our property, and you also have Lake Barrington, which is just next to us. Beautiful feature, natural beauty sort of things of the area, and a pristine walk, and almost on your own.
Now, of course, Remy doesn't nearly have enough to do, so he has a new business that's developing that he promised to tell us more about, because he decided it was time, as a Frenchman, he should get into wine business. Something perhaps to do with the fact that before you were a chef, you were a sommelier. So he's in the process of trying to introduce French wines into Tasmania, which might be a little bit of an uphill struggle, since the local wines here are so good. But Remy, give us the name of that business, and then promise that you'll get back in touch when it's more mature than it is now.
Yes, I mean, it's a Gulp Wine. It's the name of the wholesale business. The idea behind is that we find it would be difficult to get source of good traditional country wine. You know, would that be a Bergerac? Would that be a Madiron? Or, you know, a small growth of Bordeaux? We couldn't get them. Australia, probably like the U.S., it's easy to get first growth and expensive French wine import, but as soon as you're looking at something decent, regional, it becomes hard. And that's what we try to bring to Tasmania, something decent and unusual and different grape, like the Tanna, like the Malbec, things that people don't really recognize either.
So let's just finish off with the website for Glencore Rural Retreat, and then we'll say goodbye to Remy, but we'll be talking to him again in the future, I'm sure.
Yes, I will wish to see you all at Glencore one day or another, and when you're paying a visit to Australia, don't forget Tasmania. It has a lot to offer, and you'll be surprised. See you soon.
Melissa Houghton had her 15 minutes of fame in New York City selling Christmas trees, but that's a story we might come to later. The main reason we're chatting with Melissa is that she's back home at Hawley House in Hawley Beach, Tasmania. A new generation hoping to take over a property that's been in her family for 60 years, which is a marvelous place that you can stay. Melissa, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
And I want you to describe in your own words what this Hawley House experience is like. We're sitting here looking out the window at the most spectacular view you've ever seen. But there's more than that, isn't there?
There is. And I think that what makes this place more special, not only is in Tasmania, which is exotic in anybody's eyes, the idea of Tasmania, the wilderness escape, but this is a family home, and been in my family for 60 years, and we're all here, and we're still working together, and it's a really unique experience. You can be part of a family and live in a home that's rich in history, with beautiful gardens and a beautiful place, and yeah, it's pretty special.
And what do people do when they come here? Do they just hang out, or is there lots of things for them to do?
Well, we usually direct them to the bath on the roof, and that really gets people going. It's a bit of a novelty. But mainly we have these beautiful beaches, and there's a penguin, the largest colony in Tasmania, right in the point here. And especially if they're animal lovers, there's no place closer to paradise than here, because it really is we have massive 20 acres of gardens around the house, and we make our own wine. So it's basically a bit of a relaxing experience.
Yeah, you have your own wetland set up that we saw during construction a few years ago. Is that project complete now?
The project is complete. The only problem is that the sky hasn't blessed us with any rain for quite a while, so it's a bit dry right now, but we now also have a brackish water lagoon, which is harbours different species of animals and plants, and we have six other ponds, and we have a large collection of endangered frogs and birds and things. It's a haven for all animals, and even our church, which we have in the gardens, is all creatures' church. It's really... We really embrace nature and animals and things, and we try and plant species of plants and create habitats to encourage animals and things.
Now you do a lot of fine wining and dining too, right? You mentioned that you have your own wine. Talk a little bit about the kitchen too. You're all dressed up as if you were in the kitchen. So something's going on there too.
Well, normally we all pitch in a little while. Everything I cook ends up as soup, and everyone agrees with that. But the rest of my family is pretty... talented. My father he's been cooking for a long time, but we're trying to put him to pasture. We're trying to force him into retirement at home, and he's starting to enjoy it, I think. But my brother, he's a catering manager at the Gingerbread House, which is our cellar door and restaurant, another heritage house at the Spirit of Tasmania ferry terminal. And my sister, she's talented in basically everything. She's a lawyer and geneticist and winemaker. So she's responsible for the wine that we produce here, which has got very good reviews, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Rosé. And then I am a talker, and that's what I do. So we all contribute in a way, and basically the dining room experience, we showcase what's fresh and local, and we grow most of our own produce ourselves, which is my favourite thing to do, having an enormous vegetable garden, which is being protected from all the native animals we love, which like to eat it, by big netting. So we produce everything from there for the plates, and then we make a menu daily depending on what's local, what's fresh, and people who come say it's a fabulous meal just because of that it's simple and it's fresh and it's good regional cuisine.
So what are a couple of things that'll be on the menu tonight?
Well, tonight I have no idea yet. We haven't got there
yet. What about yesterday? Yesterday's probably easier.
Okay, yesterday's menu, we had Tasmanian scallops served au gratin, and we had homegrown Tasmanian avocado with a cashew nut dressing, and then we had things like Tasmanian Atlantic salmon and fresh pink ling baked with lemon and capers, and we also had, for desserts, we had our own homegrown mulberries, and our enormous mulberry tree, alongside figs, black Genoa figs that we grow, and they're on the dessert menu, and also fresh local strawberries with a chocolate brandy sauce. That's one for the ladies. and rhubarb crumble and things like that. Everything we grow ourselves, basically.
Now, those avocados wouldn't have been from Dick Shaw by any chance.
They might have been from Dick Shaw in the past, but now we've got our own tree, so... No, when it's busy, we have tamarillos from Dick Shaw and avocados, and we like to get that. He's another local producer we like to use. We're actually drinking some tamarillo liqueur right now.
and it's mid-morning coffee time, you can tell we're an adventurous lot. Now we can't stop this portion of the conversation without talking about your 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah.
In New York City. So give us a snapshot of what was going on when you became the Christmas tree lady.
Well, I haven't always dressed up for a kitchen and worked in this beautiful house. I've been a vagrant and done my travels around the world, and that involved some interesting times in America. And I got a job selling Christmas trees, where I stayed up all night on the street guarding them from thieves. That was my job. And happened to be in a really on the corner of 67 and Columbus, where a woman from the New York Times said she wanted to do a little piece on me, and it actually turned out to be an article with a photograph on the front page of the Metro section. And I was surprised as much as anybody by the reaction. I had people visiting me day and night, and I had people bringing me food and recognizing me in the street. And then I was on World News Radio in Australia talking about my experience, and it really was an American experience. I even got offered a Yale University out of it. It was pretty bizarre.
But you decided to come back home. So here's where you're going to be now, Melissa?
Yeah. I think I decided that being famous just wasn't for me. I like the modest life in Tasmania and running the business with my family. So I've come back to play with the ferrets and hang out with the dogs and really showcase what Tasmania has to offer, which is this is really the epitome of what Tasmania has, is a friendly people and good local produce and beautiful scenery. So.
Well, it's so beautiful here. It's better than a picture postcard. Looking out this window across the brackish pond and across to a wonderful inlet with mountains on the other side. So before we sign off, give us a website so that people can find out more information and they know where to contact you to get here. And last piece of information, because people would fly into either Launceston or Devonport to get here. Just give us an idea of how long it would take them to get here once they did that.
Well, Devonport Airport is only 15 minutes away, and Launceston's only an hour away, and really nothing's far from in Tasmania anyway. And if you need any more information, you can visit www.hawleyhousetas.com, where you can meet all the family on the website and all the dogs as well, and you can see what's in the area that you can see from our place and get there's some good photographs in there too. And there's a menu, a sample menu.
Now that's a .com, that's not a .com.au, that's a .com.
Just .com, yeah.
So it's hawleyhousetas.com. Melissa, thank you so much for talking to us, and I know you're going to be happy here, but now you probably want to go back and play with the ferrets some more.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, thanks.
Well, this is making me wish we were back there.
That was a big sigh of relief. Are you pleased the program's over? Or are you
I was just sighing because I always had such a good time, and I just so love Hawley House. They're old friends, and that's always good when you're 10,000 miles away.
Put Tasmania on your map. Please do visit our friends. They'll be looking forward to hearing from you, and we'll be looking forward to hearing from you via email, and we'll be ready again with another exciting show, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.